Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I wanted to talk this morning on grace, mercy, and forgiveness. Let me start by repeating the dedication I made at the beginning of the ceremony because it's related. This is the Festival of Buddhist Martyrs. And the verse I read is from the Dinkaroku, Rinpoche Master Ji's translation of Keizan. And it's a verse from the Lotus Scripture. It's actually a verse, different translation of the verse from the Scripture on the Immeasurable Life of the Tathagata. And it reads, constantly I'm at the Ryozen meeting throughout the endless ages. Ryozen is how the Japanese refer to Vulture Peak. Even should there be a great fire, my heart is always safe and calm and filled with angels. There's always peace in the midst of destruction. We have this festival because in the early 90s, when Reverend Master Ji was putting together our yearly festival calendar, there was a news item about a mass grave being discovered in Mongolia. Apparently 40,000 monastics, you know, men and women, had been killed and buried there. And she felt it would be good to have a ceremony that in which we offered merit to those who died, defending the Dharma, defending the truth, not in a militaristic way, but just as a result of their faith, just as a result of just being a Buddhist. Their karma, for whatever reason, brought them into conflict with the governments or society they lived in, and they were killed, persecuted, tortured, executed. It's been a hard 20th century. Was a hard century for Buddhists. There were many Buddhists that were in the southern part of the Russian Empire who suffered under the Stalin years. Of course, we've got Tibet, we've got China, we've got Mongolia, in the Southeast Asia. Pretty much anywhere there were Buddhists, there seems to have been a war in the past century, and many times the Buddhists were the ones who suffered, as well as other people, but there's a great number there who could use our merit, or at least we want to offer our merit and our gratitude. I often think when we chant the ancestral line in the morning, you know, the ancestors are just like the highest peak of a great wave. And for every ancestor, there's a huge wave that supports that one person. Okay, so we're seeing successive waves as we chant the ancestral line. And those successive waves are just the ordinary people like ourselves who support the Dharma, provide the conditions in which an ancestor could come forth and offer the Dharma. I wanted to talk about grace, mercy, and forgiveness, because over the years I've been asked by people, what are the Buddhist equivalents of these terms? These are terms that are in concepts that are used more in Christianity. I don't profess to have studied Christian theology. What I know of Christianity is what Reverend Master Ji taught us, what I learned growing up in a Protestant household, what I read on Wikipedia. So if my presentation of Christian doctrine is a bit shallow or not as subtle as it might be, that's why. And I'm trying to just use those as a foil in which to talk about Buddhist concepts in more depth. And so please grant me your forgiveness if some of you who know more than I do think I'm being a bit shallow. And I don't mean to be critical of our Christian friends, because many people have come to the truth via that path as well. First, there's grace. someone once asked me, well, what's the Buddhist equivalent of grace? And my immediate response was, well, we already exist in a state of grace. Okay? It's not something that has to be given. We already exist in a state of original purity, if you want to put it that way, in contrast to, say, original sin. We already have everything that we need. It doesn't have to be given from an external source. We find it within ourselves. There's the old spiritual amazing grace. Okay, well, actually, every moment we exist in a state of grace. It's not a one-time thing. We're always in a state of grace, because we're never cut off from our own Buddha nature. And we can cover it up. Most of us have or do, or hopefully we won't do too much more in the future, having found the Dharma. But that grace, that I sometimes think of it as unearned merit, you know, is always there. The second term, mercy, that term we know a lot about in Buddhism. We use the term compassion. Okay, in China, Kuan Yin or Kan Zhan is sometimes called the goddess of mercy. If you look up the word mercy in a Chinese dictionary, what you discover is that it's a compound word, and it's made up of the two Chinese characters for karuna, which is Sanskrit for compassion, in Maitri, or metta, which is loving kindness. Okay, so our equivalent of mercy would be compassion, loving kindness. And it gets extended, I think, on out to the other two of what are called the immeasurables, or the Brahma Viharas, which is empathic joy and equanimity. Okay. Mercy encompasses all of those four qualities for us. And then we come to forgiveness. This is a word you just don't find in many of our scriptures or many writings from Asia. But it's definitely something that is an important principle in Buddhism. And the way we usually talk about it is as generosity of spirit. I want to read you something that River Master Jiyu offered as part of a Jukai talk. It's on the precepts on the Kechi Myaku, the bloodline of the Buddhas. He's writing this at a time when there had been a lot of unpleasant things that happened. A lot of people monks who disappointed her disciples. And it's wonderful to see how she responds to that without any sense of being punitive. Okay. She says, it's a transcript of what she said, "Perhaps one of the greatest gifts of all Buddhism is the learning of generosity of spirit, for without it, Buddhism does not live. Gratitude for the teaching, generosity of spirit to all, no matter what may or may not have happened, the recognition of the law of karma, which is inexorable, over which neither I nor you nor anyone else in this world has power, the fact that the consequences of actions are the consequences thereof, and that no living person has the right to heap coals on the fires of hell. Just the red line going on, going from yesterday to today, and from today and tomorrow. To be a Buddhist is to keep the precepts from one day to the next and make sure of the meaning of that keeping. It is to keep the red line strong, vibrant, and flowing, one year to another, on to eternity. Above all this year, let us learn generosity of spirit. The keeping of the precepts leads to peace within the heart, which leads to true joy, which leads to gratitude that is unbounded, which gives birth to generosity of spirit, and generosity of spirit gives birth to trust. And then he enjoins those to not let themselves become clogged with self-ideas and doubts, delusions, and ends with, always keep generosity of spirit before your eyes and in your heart, no matter what you witness or experience. The way that forgiveness is used in Christianity, coming out of Judaism, has a specific history. And this is something I learned on Wikipedia, which I didn't know before. But in Judaism, it's almost a legal term. Forgiveness could be granted and restitution made only if the person kind of apologized and made that restitution. I think there's the sense in Christianity, and again, my presentation may be rather shallow, that with forgiveness, often it gives the impression that there's no karmic consequences. Okay? And the Buddhist view of this is there's complete forgiveness or embracing, and there's still the recognition of karmic consequences. Okay. The example that I think of the most is the example of Angulimala, who was the serial killer at the time of the Buddha. He had killed 999 people. He was about to kill his mother in order to make his 1,000th victim. He had been given this task by his teacher, who had been turned against him by jealous fellow students. So he actually had a purpose behind this 1,000 victim goal. The Buddha caught on to what was about to happen and put himself in the path of Angulimala so that Angulimala would kind of go after him instead of his mother. Because the Buddha knew the dire karmic consequences of killing one's parent. And Angulimala started chasing the Buddha. And the Buddha, you know, somehow always went faster than Angulimala could keep up with. And Angulimala started saying, stop, stop, you know, stop. And the Buddha said, Angulimala, I have stopped. He's referring to the creation of karma. I have stopped. It's time for you to stop. Okay? And somehow that pierced through and got to Angulimala. And he recognized what he was doing, the harm that he was causing, and he turned his life around. He became a monk, actually became an arhat, which was the highest level of attainment that one could reach. But there was still karmic consequence for what he had done. And that played out in a couple of ways. One was that when the people saw him, they went to the king, whose army was more or less kind of the police and the FBI, kind of all rolled in together, and they went after him. And because obviously here was someone who had caused great harm and execution was the usual karmic consequence of murder. And they went and tried to extract him from the monastery, and the Buddha kind of stepped in between and said, no, he's turned around. You know, execution would be useless in this point because he's already turned his life around. the fact that the Buddha was a good friend of the king probably had, you know, something to do with it. But the army officers respected that, and they allowed Angulimala to live. However, when Angulimala would go out on alms round, people would recognize him, and they would throw stones, sticks, whatever, at him. You know, even though he was a monk, even though he was begging for alms, there was still this resentment and hatred toward him. And he went to the Buddha. He was all kind of bloody and bruised and so forth, and talking to the Buddha about it. The Buddha said, "Bear it, monk, bear it. This is the karmic consequence for what you have done. If you hadn't turned around, you might have been in hell many times over. This is light karmic consequence compared to what you might have merited if you hadn't turned around." So there's still karmic consequence for what we do. There can be forgiveness, and there's still karmic consequence. In the Dhammapada, which is probably one of the oldest of the Buddhist scriptures, some of the opening verses address this as well. They're somewhat called the twin verses because they come in twos. And I want us to look at a couple of them. One is we're going to look at 3 and 4. This is 3, which this particular translation titles, "Retaliation Does Not Lead to Peace." And this is the Buddha's quoting someone and saying, "He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me." End of quote. In those who harbor such thoughts, hatred is not appeased. Again, in quotes, "He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me." In those who do not harbor such thoughts, hatred is appeased. And then the other verse is the one which is one of my favorites. The Buddha said, "Hatreds never cease through hatred in this world. Through love alone they cease. This is an eternal law." I think one of the most profound things that the Buddha said, and you see it in lots of places, not always given credit to the Buddha, but it expresses an eternal truth. It expresses a truth that is holds regardless of one's faith or religion or political view or whatever. It's an eternal law. And I want to just read you the background story of this teaching. That's how the Dhammapada is. There's a verse, and then it'll give the background story behind why the Buddha said a particular thing. And this is called the bitter feud through various existences. "Once there lived a householder whose wife was barren. Being unable to bear a child, and afraid that she would be mistreated by her husband and her mother-in-law, she herself selected and arranged for her husband to marry another woman." This was common in those days for men to have several wives. "But on two occasions, as soon as she knew the second wife was pregnant, the barren wife gave her food mixed with drugs, causing her to have miscarriages. On the third pregnancy, the fruitful wife kept it to herself without informing the barren wife. But when the latter came to know about it, she again caused an abortion. Eventually, the second wife died in childbirth. Before her death, the unfortunate woman was filled with hatred and vowed vengeance on the barren wife and her future offspring. Thus the feud started. Among their later existences, the two were reborn as a hen and a cat, a doe and a leopardess, otherwise beings who one of them was a predator and the other one was prey. Eventually, one was reborn as the daughter of a nobleman in Shravasti, and the other one was an ogress." Now, what is an ogress in our contemporary mind? It's someone who was deranged. Okay, that's the way I think about it. Okay. One day the demon, and she has a name, she's Kala Yakshini. And again, oftentimes, I'm not sure it's the case here, but often the case in Buddhist scriptures, when you see references to demons, it's referring to a state of mind. Okay, at that time, that was how, it was sort of the psychology of the day, is that they would think of these states of mind as demons. Okay. One day, Kala Yakshini was in hot pursuit of the nobleman's daughter and her baby. Okay. Yakshas or Yakshinis, in this case, eight children. When the lady heard that the Buddha was giving a religious discourse at the Jetavana monastery, she fled to him and placed her son at his feet for protection. The demon was thus prevented from entering the monastery. Now you'll notice in all Buddhist stories, the Buddha, the power of the Buddha always is stronger than the demons. Okay, it's a good example of how the truth is always stronger than evil. Okay, you can think of the Buddha sitting beneath the Bodhi tree when Mara attacks. Okay, in all of these stories, the Buddha, even the worst demons, let alone the gods, have to bow to the Buddha. Okay, they can't. They recognize the power of the Buddha's purity, the strength, the truth of what he represents, and they have to bow to that. However, the Buddha later called in the demon, and both the lady and the ogress were admonished by the Buddha. The Buddha told them about their past feud as rival wives and how they had been harboring hatred towards each other and killing each other's offspring through their various lives. They were made to see that hatred could only cause more hatred and that it could only cease through friendship, understanding, and goodwill. Both realized their mistakes and, on the admonition of the Buddha, made their peace with each other. The story doesn't end there, though. The Buddha's going to ask them to manifest their new mind, if you will. So he requested the noblewoman to hand over her son to the ogress. All right? Here's this woman, she's being asked to hand her baby in over into the hands of someone who had just been trying to kill it and devour it. Fearing for the safety of her son, she hesitated. But because of her devotion and confidence in the Buddha, she handed over her son as requested. The child was warmly received by the ogress. After kissing and caressing the child tenderly like her very own son, the ogress handed over the child back to his mother. As a result of this episode, there was much goodwill on both sides. And that's the story that gives behind hatreds never cease through hatred in this world. Through love alone they cease. This is an eternal law. And there's one version of the story that there's a sequel, not a sequel exactly, but something tagged on the end, and that's that the ogress, for whatever reason, I'm not real up on a Buddhist demonology of the, 5th century BC, but she converted and no longer desired to devour children. But as a result, though, she had nothing to eat. And so the Buddha instructed the noblewoman to plant gardens in order to feed the ogress. So that even she had changed her life, the ogress had changed her life, and the Buddha wanted to make sure that she still had some kind of livelihood, that she still had nourishment and could live out her life. Another story that's contemporary that I think really is useful to understand the Buddhist concept of forgiveness or generosity of spirit. Takes place in Cambodia. It's one that River Master Ji related once. I've heard it slightly differently, I think, than the way she told it. But there was, after the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot and the killing of, I can't remember how many million people in Cambodia, pretty much anyone who had any sort of education or training, even if you had glasses, that made you a sign that you, somehow you were an intellectual and therefore were killed. pretty brutal. But there was, this was afterwards, and there was this one village, and it was a reporter, an American reporter, who was visiting the village, and he knows that there was a woman who lived on the outskirts of town, and the people would bring her food. And the woman's living but sort of as a homeless person. And the reporter asked about this, and the villagers told her, well, she had been instrumental in the killing of many people as part of the Khmer Rouge. And out of sympathy for her, even though she was, you know, or because she was a homeless person at that point, she was still reaping the karmic consequences of what she'd done, they wanted to make sure that she lived. You know, they had compassion for her and wanted to not destroy her life. And the reporter just, you know, he just couldn't fathom this. You say, well, she should be executed, don't you think? And that's the law of this land, isn't it? And the people would say, well, no, she's turned her heart around. Okay, she's converted. There's no need for that now. And we're quite happy to give her sustenance and help her in this way. And the reporter just went away kind of shaking his head because he just couldn't understand it. He just couldn't fathom that that much generosity of spirit. When we talk about generosity of spirit, for me, it's the generosity of the Buddha nature. Okay, because we all have it, and we all have it completely, we can be generous. Okay, there's nothing to hold on to. The Buddha nature is not our personal experience. It's not our personal possession. And we can share with others freely and not lose anything thereby. This is the principle behind the transfer of merit. Okay, we give merit. We can give anything. And we know that we really don't lose anything by giving. We actually receive more as a result. Okay. There, someone gave me a book a while back. It's called The Book of Joy. And it's about dialogues between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was in apartheid Africa. And Desmond Tutu was asked by Nelson Mandela to preside over this, they don't call it a court, let me see what they called it. They called it it pointed in the chair of what they called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Okay. And what happened was that they set up this, I guess you could call it a court, but if people would come and admit to what they had done, there would be no punishment. There would be no penalty. And so you had people who had been, you know, grievously harmed, their family killed, tortured, you know, really horrible things as a result of apartheid in South Africa. And then they were mainly black people, okay? And then usually the white people who had been in the ruling class, often police officers would explain what they did. And it was a remarkable thing that just their willingness to confess to what they had done was adequate recompense for the other people who'd been harmed. Okay. There was no, it resolved the sense of vengeance and revenge. There's a principle in South African culture called Ubuntu or Ubuntu, which comes out something like the essence of humanity. Okay. It's encompasses compassion, loving kindness. For me, it really comes down to Buddha nature, you know, a recognition of the interconnection of all beings, which again is a Buddhist concept that we know for ourselves. And I know one monk here thought that, you know, the reason this court, if you will, was successful because the people had that as part of their culture. Okay. They had as part of their culture that generosity of spirit, that essence of humanity in which they knew all beings are connected. And therefore they were able to let go of their hatred, let go of their resentment of the people who had caused them harm. Okay. It's a really remarkable event in the history of humanity, really, that you could take that kind of situation and it could take such a positive turn. Okay. In this book, that Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama are talking about their own experience, and both of them have known great sorrow, great grief as a result of other people. They were holding, it was held as a birthday party for the Dalai Lama. It was held in India. And they held it at, a Tibetan children's village. So there were, 2,000 children or something there, but it was a big party. And they allowed the children to come up and ask questions. And one of the children asked the Dalai Lama, well, how can you possibly forgive the Chinese people for what they've done? And the Dalai Lama talks about how he responded to the terrible things that happened to the Tibetan people. And he's referring to specifically to a recent event at the time, it was several years ago, where there was some kind of uprising or revolt in the Chinese really cracked down hard on the Tibetan people for that. And the Dalai Lama said, I just tried so hard to just cultivate loving kindness, you know, toward the Chinese people and the people who were doing these things. And he says, I just wouldn't let hatred take root in my heart. He said, I just really wished for their well-being. And he also, as he said, he had felt sorrow for the people who were doing these acts, these really, really harmful, destructive acts. I know for myself when I heard about 9/11, I was at the Eugene Priory at the time, and one of the congregation members called me, you know, and said, "Turn on your television. You got to see this." And so I turned it on and I watched. And one of my first thoughts was the grief that I felt for the people who were in those planes that actually were causing the destruction, that were causing the deaths of all, you know, several thousand people. Because the karmic consequence of that is just tremendous. To die, who of us is innocent, but to die innocently, as many of our Buddhist martyrs did, just because they were Buddhist. Okay, is one thing, but to intentionally take the life of another being is quite another. Okay, the consequences are quite different. And so the Dalai Lama was talking about his own sorrow and thinking about what the future of these people, these individuals were who were taking the lives of people who just wanted to live and practice their own religion the way they wanted to. Another way that one can work with this kind of anger, resentment, is to reflect on the causes. You know, what are the causes of this? And we reflect it. You kind of work out. You can kind of see. Well, there's a reason for this to happen. It helps take kind of the sting out of it. You can get a certain equanimity about it. A little bit of distancing, so that one can not give in to, you know, kind of our normal human reaction of hatred, you know, or ill will, you know, vengeance. Now, a few of us are, you know, will probably, let's hope, never be executed or tortured or persecuted. But all of us face unhappiness in our life from time to time. All of us find ourselves with anger arising. All of us find ourselves with hatred arising. All of us find ourselves with craving arising. And what we can do is the same thing that the Dalai Lama did, same thing that Buddhist martyrs did, is that we sit still. Okay? The verse I read from the Denko Roku, again, it comes from the scripture we did this morning, the scripture on the immeasurable life of the Tathagata. Constantly I'm at the Ryozen meeting throughout the endless ages. Even should there be a great fire, my heart is always safe and calm and filled with angels. This is the Buddha's promise, that no matter what happens, he will be there. Okay. Now, it's not saying that somehow Shakyamuni is going to come back to life and be there. It means that in our hearts we can know the Buddha nature. We can know the Buddha mind. And in the scripture we did this morning, the way it's translated is... when sentient beings see a kalpa's ending, the raging fire is consuming all. Now, hopefully none of us will be around at kalpa's ending, but a kalpa is an indefinite length of time. So at any moment we can feel as if we're at the kalpa's ending. Okay? We're upset. Okay? We're unhappy with what we see people in our government doing. We're unhappy, you know, really... You know, terrified of what people are doing with military weapons in our country. There's all sorts of things that, you know, which we can feel as if the raging fires are consuming all. And we can feel a great deal of distress about that. And Buddha says, tranquil will this realm of mine be, ever filled with devas and humans and parks and groves, amongst towers and palaces bedecked with gems of every kind. Under bejeweled trees heavy with blossoms and fruit, may these beings take their delight in play, whilst devas beat their heavenly drums, ever making pleasing music, and showering down coral tree flowers upon the Buddha and his great assembly. My Pure Land will not be destroyed, though sentient beings may see it as utterly consumed by fire, letting themselves be filled with grief and horror, distress and fear. The Buddha is saying that when we sit still, we can know that pure land. Okay, it can seem like a pretty fantastic statement unless one has experienced it. But that's what's offered to us. Just if we can just sit still. Okay, if we can sit still and know our own Buddha nature, we know that we're in the pure land. We know that pure land. Great Master Dogen in the Shobogenzo has a chapter in which he refers to this section of the scripture, and it's called Kenbutsu, which is seeing Buddha, encountering Buddha. And Dogen makes the point, well, just as Shakyamuni is always present, so the divine vulture peak is always here. Rivermaster Hubert, in translating this passage, intentionally called it the divine vulture peak to move it out of, he's not talking about a geographical place, okay, but a state of mind and heart, okay, the divine vulture peak. If we can sit still there and not give in to our anger, our hatred, our unhappiness, we can know peace of heart. Now, it may take a lot of moments of doing that before we experience it fully, but that's where the faith comes in, okay? To sit still and not give in to the vengeance, the hatred, the unhappiness that we see as a result of suffering caused by other beings. Dalai Lama also says, well, this doesn't mean you shouldn't speak out, okay? Ramesh Ji often told us, don't be a doormat. But what's important is for us to be still, and as Master Ji translated, even should there be a great fire, my heart is always safe and calm and filled with angels. He's using the angels, this kind of a translation of devas. But we have that kind of heavenly joy. We have that kind of heavenly peace within our own hearts. I'll just close with coming back to what Reverend Master Ji said on generosity of spirit. We can be generous because we know the Buddha nature. It's our true nature to be generous. And as she said, no matter what happens, continue to be generous in spirit. Be generous from the place of the Buddha nature. And it's hard to improve on her words, so I think I'll close there.